putting Florida's children first. We'll tell you why and how in just a moment. Good Thursday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9, and now subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, honoring those leading the campaign for Florida's at-risk kids. What are your questions for Florida's children first? Get on the line now at 549-2937. Also this morning, how Jacksonville's historic Norman Film Studios could become a national landmark. The Girl Scouts of Gateway Council CEO joins the show, then later weekend events with The Spectator, including this weekend's Jacks by Jacks event for writers, all of that ahead. But first this hour, they are child advocates who are being honored as game changers in the Jacksonville community. Tonight, the group Florida's Children First will recognize champions for children's rights at a special event. But their larger goal is to fight for the rights of at-risk kids throughout the state, especially disabled kids and children in the foster care system. Christine Spadeus, Executive Director of Florida's Children First, joins us in studio with more. Christine, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
And when it comes to issues in Florida, whether it's the foster care system, the rights of disabled children, or more, what are your questions and comments? Get on the line now at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect and email and tweet the show. And so tonight, Christine, at the Haskell Building in Jacksonville, you will honor some local child advocates you've singled out as game changers, including State Senator Rob Bradley and Hank and Mary Cox, Children's Advocates of the Year here in Jacksonville. What's going to be happening this evening?
Well, it's going to be a fantastic evening. I think that our focus this time is children at risk and in juvenile justice issues. And so both of these groups, Mary and Hank Cox, of course, were so involved with the Christian Fernandez case. And that has been a national focus, really, not just locally and certainly statewide. And so in the representation of Christian Fernandez, the youngest child to be charged with first-degree murder in Jacksonville, and by Hank and Mary being his guardian ad litem, we are giving them an award for the great work they did.
Hank Cox, local defense attorney, advocated pro bono along with some other lawyers on behalf of Christian Fernandez. He could have gone to prison for life after the death of his younger brother. He is now in a juvenile facility, and he will be released at the age of maturity. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And so you want to honor the Coxes. Also, Senator Rob Bradley, champion for children's rights. Why Senator Bradley?
Well, Senator Bradley has had a short career so far at the state capitol, but he has done amazing things. One of the big things he did was rewrite the juvenile justice laws and focusing on the fact that we need to have less restrictive placements for a lot of these children. They need to be in their community so that they can be, you know, therapy with the family.
And how does that work exactly? How will the law change the setup?
There has been some substantial changes. Large institutionalized facilities are not to be touted any longer. We want to look for a family type setting, smaller, you know, six children in a setting in the community so that the parents can be involved. These kids are coming back to the community and they're coming back home.
And we want your calls when it comes to issues of Florida juvenile justice and Florida's Children First, 549-2937. How did the organization get formed, Florida's Children First?
We were started 13 years ago, originally by a group of attorneys from across the state that started to realize that they were working on the same type of issues, but across the state. So they saw there are statewide systemic issues that we need to tackle, and this nonprofit was formed.
When you say systemic issues, can you be a little more specific? What are some examples?
Well, some examples of a systemic issue is children that are in foster care that were not able to participate in any kind of normal activity, being able to have a friend sleep over or to go and stay at a friend's house from school. You'd have to have the parents' background checked, fingerprint taken. So it stopped our children from having normal lives. And it wasn't just in one community that this was happening.
It was all over the state.
All over.
So reform to the state's statutes was needed in terms of how kids in the foster care system are generally treated.
Right, to give them a normal life.
What else?
Well, there's a variety of issues, but let's go into the juvenile justice arena. You're looking at children that are taken into custody at such young ages, oftentimes because of the trauma that's happened in their life. There's not a big difference in a lot of the backgrounds of these children than the children that are in the dependency system. And it is important that those children have trauma-informed care, that the people who are working with them to rehabilitate them see that it's the trauma that's causing some of the behavior. And until that was recognized, that was an issue across the state.
And how does Florida compare to other states when you look at its juvenile justice laws and the way we treat our kids in the system?
Florida does direct files at a higher rate than many other states, which means that we automatically place children into the adult system for serious offenses. Across the country, we do have issues with race, and we have an overabundance of children of color that come into our system, but Florida is not unique in that area.
And what are your calls and questions for Christine Spudeus, Executive Director of Florida's Children First? 549-2937, Frank in Jacksonville. Hi, Frank. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. My name is Frank, and I sit on a board here in Jacksonville of a reform school called AMI Kids. It was formerly the Jacksonville Marine Institute. And we just renovated a schoolhouse on Beach Boulevard and can house about 45 students. This school is a wonderful reform program for a lot of these kids that you're talking about. One of the questions that I have is, and one of the problems that we are having as a board is our attendance level is not what we would like for it to be. We currently have 35 enrolled students now, and these kids are having a hard time getting to the actual school. And I know it's a parent problem, but a lot of these kids are in social settings that aren't what would be beneficial to them getting to the school. Do you have any comment, or could you offer any solutions to our problem?
Transportation issues are issues all over the state. We know that, but I have to commend you because AMI is a fantastic program, mm-hmm. not just in Florida, but across the country. And it is a wonderful place for children. And, I wish I could give you the answer to that issue of transportation.
How do people come up with solutions? What have you heard about?
Well, you work in the community. You know, you try to get a group that gets involved enough. But, you know, what do you buy? A van and pick up the kids, you know? Have somebody go out.
People just make it work somehow.
You're going to have to do that.
549-2937, Ricky on the north side. Hi, Ricky.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Well, for one thing, I wanted to find out from the guest about the fact that a lot of cuts has been done on education and to help children, especially what Mr. Scott is doing, the governor is doing right now. He wants to cut taxes by at least $1 billion. So my question is, how's the funding for some of these programs and problems that we want to solve? How are we going to get it? Or where is it coming from? And how can people volunteer if they have to? That's my question.
Thanks, Ricky. Funding. Christine.
Well, you know, the state has a general revenue, and that is the pie, and you can't make the pie bigger unless we actually start having taxes in our state, which we know we're not going to do. So you have to set priorities. And I know that Governor Scott put a bundle of money into education last year, but it didn't raise it back up to the level it had been before all those cuts. So you're absolutely right. This caller is so correct on the lack of, you know, the necessary funding for our kids in education.
Well, Florida's Children First was formed to raise awareness about children's issues, build partnerships and coalitions, but most importantly, to create a constituency for the children of Florida to advocate for children in Tallahassee, because children can't advocate for themselves. That's and that right. includes the dollars, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, we're fortunate enough that we can bring up children with us that are voices for other children. So we bring current and former foster youth in, but they talk about those issues, the education issues and the issues in their communities.
Are there any pieces of pending legislation that will be moving in the near or long term that will help your cause?
We're not working on an education piece this specific session. So in that sense, no. But we have other legislation that's out there, and one has to do with the tuition exemption, which is children in foster care are able to go to college and have a tuition exemption because they've not had parents to help them prepare for their future. And so we're having a bill to clarify that legislation. There's a lot of things that we do every year. Mm-hmm. But there's so many issues that you have to focus or you're not going to succeed. So top issues are education, mental health, disability rights, and foster care and dependency. And we can only pick a couple of things in each area.
Sure, at a time. And here's a follow-up tweet from a listener. What can we as citizens do to support Florida's Children First? And what legislation should we be supporting or fighting in the year to come?
Well, we are a nonprofit, so clearly donations are extraordinarily important to us. But we also work with volunteers around the state, hundreds of volunteers. So please contact us at our website, Florida's Children First, is www.floridaschildrenfirst.org. Or call our office. You'll find our phone numbers on the site, and we can help link you up.
And let's go now to Jody in Mandarin. Hi, Jody. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I am interested in hearing what Christina can tell us about what Florida's Children First does to help attorneys become better advocates and spot legal issues for children who are in the justice, who are justice involved, who may not, who have other issues that are coming up that can and should be addressed by competent counsel. A lot of times these issues get missed, and then they percolate, and then they begin to fester sometimes and really, really harm the child's future because they're not nipped in the bud or addressed early on when they may could have been prevented from escalating. So perhaps Christina can speak to that question.
Well, that's an excellent question. It just so happens we do a lot of work in creating and supporting pro bono, you know, which is for free, attorney projects across the state. Florida's one of 10 states that does not provide paid counsel for children in dependency. However, thanks to Senator Bradley, which is another reason we're giving him an award tonight as our champion, he co-sponsored a bill that for the first time ever provided for paid counsel for children with very special needs that are in foster care. But there are so many children outside of that group that we have pro bono projects. There is a ripe one, a robust one in Jacksonville. Judge Gooding is involved. The Jacksonville Legal Aid is involved. We provided the training and we do supports. It's phenomenal.
Bill in Clay County. Hello, Bill. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Melissa. How are you doing this morning?
All right.
Good. I really enjoy your guest. I think she's really hanging out some really strong points in the terms of helping kids in Florida. But I have one question for, in that regard, the kids in foster care as compared to kids that come up for adoption. We run into situations where people adopt foster care kids with the intent of adopting, and once they find out that in the adoption process, there's not as many resources allocated. My question is, in terms of a kid in dependency, he has all sorts of access to therapy, psychological evaluations, and things of that nature. We know that when kids are adopted, at some point in time in their lives, they have a tendency to react to the fact that they've been adopted. My question is, why don't we have the same level of services for adopted kids in terms of psychological evaluations and counseling and revenue and college opportunities that we do for kids in foster care? Because they're still going to continue down the same path in terms of their lives. They're still going to be facing the same issues when they get older. And I'll take my answer up here. Thank you.
Bill, what an insightful question. Christine.
That's an amazing question. And I can only really focus on children adopted from foster care. And boy, is he right, Anna, with that.
Mm-hmm.
You have to fight to get these kids on the APD waiver before they're adopted so that they can have access to those kind of services. And you're right about the fact that those adoptions, those kids will enrich your life, but there are a host of issues that can come up. And unless the adoptive family is fully supported and informed and are ready for those kind of issues, because these children really don't know how to live in a family and they fight the connection because they've never had it.
Mm-hmm.
You give them that year and work with them and you're going to have the most wonderful, you know, successful family, but we have far too many failed adoptions. And that is an issue we do want to tackle in the very near future.
And Lynn in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Lynn. Good morning.
Hi. I'm glad you had this subject on. And as soon as I heard the something about the governor doing money related to some of these areas, my ears perked up, especially because when I was a guidance counselor, there's a law in the schools that if a child comes and they complain or the teacher has seen bruises and so forth on them, that the guidance counselor or someone must call Tallahassee and report that. Once the governor came in and he cut finances considerably the first time around, there was maybe one person, as opposed to four in the past, that were available. All of those jobs had been cut back to quote-unquote save money. So it might be a whole day of waiting for someone to come from this area that could speak to that child, and then before the bus took them home. That was the first thing. The second is the whole business about the governor recently saying that he's cutting back, you know, he's going to cut back on taxes and so forth. Schools, the teachers are really responsible for or taking responsibility for so much of the materials that the students need in school. And, you know, this is part of this whole situation with the governor. I'm afraid he just doesn't follow through well for the children of Florida at all. Thank you.
Well, there's a little bit of good news, although it's based on some really bad news. There was a series of articles from the Miami Herald a couple years ago, award-winning series about over 500 child deaths in Florida at the hands of caregivers after there have been calls to the hotline of DCF involvement. And they were over a period of many years. But the point is that there was a big push. You know, you can have something that will be the impetus to having major change. So there was a lot of funding put into more child protective investigators. And I'm hoping that issue the caller spoke about is just a year or two ago, because that should be alleviated.
Christine Spadeas, Executive Director of Florida's Children First, in town this morning for a special event tonight honoring champions for children in our region. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Much more still ahead on the show. Later, weekend events with The Spectator, including that Jax by Jax event. We'll tell you about it. Plus, a conversation with the woman who leads one of the top leadership development groups in town, the Girl Scouts of Gateway Council. But up next, how this city's Norman Studios could become a national landmark. Back in a moment.
Tough times on Wall Street hit everybody, from investment bankers to the guy who sells them a slice of pizza every day for lunch.
Wall Street, that's the trend. It goes up, but it goes down, and it is getting slower and slower.
What isn't slowing down is our coverage of the news that matters. We'll tell you why the stocks swing and how to make sense of it on Marketplace. Business news for the rest of us. Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Hi, I'm Daniel Austin. On the next episode of WJCT's Hometown, be inspired by Jacksonville Beach artist Gene LaJoy. Be transformed by local photographer Christina Karst. Filmmakers Keegan Ann Fuso and Drew Brown of Gray Area Films shed light on an untold story. And local artist Jeff Lukey shares Girl with Flowers. Explore the people, places, and events in your hometown. Tonight at 8 on WJCT Public Television.
Looking for fresh music? Join us weeknights at 7 for After Hours. You'll hear everything from jazz to electronica, only on 89.9 FM After Hours.
Welcome back. Well, it's a rare opportunity to preserve Jacksonville's incredible film legacy. The city's Norman Silent Film Studios is already listed on the National Register of Historic Places, but now it has the chance to become a national landmark. The nomination will actually be presented next week in Washington, D.C. Spokeswoman Rita Reagan is here now to explain how this all came about and how the public can help. Rita, good morning.
Hi there.
So, the Norman Studios could be landmarked. How about that? That means nobody can touch it ever, right?
It's very important.
Yeah, yes. That's what being a landmark is all about. How did this happen?
Well, it's a 20-year process.
You just sighed. You're tired, aren't you? 20 years of working would tire somebody out. You've been working on this for 20 years?
Yeah, a woman in Arlington figured out what that derelict property was about in 1993, I think it was, and said that, well, she was a planner, so she could tell. And so she knew it was a valuable property. She recruited a bunch of us, and we started lobbying the city. Eventually, in 2000, they bought it. And then took years to be able to get it stabilized. So the exteriors look pretty good. They're no longer an eyesore. But at any rate, the National Park Service has been interested in it all along. But finally, about a year and a half ago, they put together a committee to do the paperwork. It's a long process to do the research and to create the application. So that was finished and sent to Washington in April, I guess, of this year. But we missed the big committee. So this is a subcommittee. They'll make all the decisions, and then it will go to the big committee and the Secretary of Interior next April. So we won't literally be a national landmark until then. But they treat us like one already.
They treat you like one already?
Well, they think this property is a very important thing. It's part of the three things in Jacksonville that that tell the experience of African American in the North Florida. And one is, of course, Kingsley Plantation, and the other is American Beach. And so they figure this is the same type of thing.
Let's explain why, because the Norman Studios, and by the way, if you've never been, it's at 6337 Arlington Road. is an incredible treasure trove of history from the era when Jacksonville was a mecca for silent film production, including films that featured African-American performers. It's really something that so many that live in this area don't know about it, but should know about.
Well, Jacksonville was the center of film production from 1907 to 1919. And that's a long, interesting story how politics ran it out of town. But Norman
Stewart didn't like the film people, did they?
No, it was very...
They thought they were immoral.
Immoral, and they did things that irritated the public and so forth. But the great thing about Norman Studios is it started out in 1916 as Eagle Film City. And so it bridges the era when the original group of people were here. And then when everybody else went west... to Hollywood.
Basically, Hollywood became Hollywood.
Right. We were Hollywood before Hollywood.
We could have been Hollywood.
Yes.
Right.
That's another whole story. But anyway, Richard Norman grew up in Jacksonville, in Springfield. And that's where he and his brothers ran a movie industry. But he went off and did it in the Midwest for a long time. So he came home and bought Eagle Film City when all this was falling apart. But in the meantime, he had learned about this thing called race films, which were an antidote to the awful stereotypical racist types of films that were made with black people if they got a chance to be in the movies. Usually it was white people in blackface. Anyway, he bought this. He started making these race films that he had discovered out in the
positive
Midwest.
Positive portrayals. Mm,
positive portrayals. Wonderful adventure films and so forth. So that's why Norman Studios is such an important property because it bridges both of these periods of time for Jacksonville film.
When people visit, they can learn so much about that era. And what do they get to see? What's on exhibit?
Well, if you come over for the Arlington Aglow, which is going to be December the 12th, we'll be having tours and films and so forth. What they can see right now is unfinished interiors. But we have displays. And we talk about all the wonderful architectural features that are there. We have things like gigantic steam engines, which created the energy to pump the water and to make the lights for the films. We have a gigantic safe where they kept the film because it was so volatile, it would explode and burn the place
down.
Very
flammable.
Right.
Yeah.
And the screening room, the original screening room, and the original projection room. We've got a lot of wonderful things, and we hope to start a capital campaign next year and start on the process of turning this into a multi-purpose facility, which will be educational as well as making films.
It is incredible to think about the fact that the filmmaking industry began pretty much 100 years ago. They started in New York City, but they realized they couldn't shoot year-round in New York. So
right.
they came down the train, they came down the railroad tracks down the East Coast, and they stopped here in Jacksonville. And this is really where they started to figure out how to make movies here in Jacksonville.
On location, because location shots were very impossible. And, of course, lighting was the big thing.
Yeah.
Climate and lighting were the big issues that drove people south. And that's another wonderful story as well, how they discovered Jacksonville and how the Great Fire of 1901 really laid the foundation for doing this.
How did the fire play in?
Because we were a modern city. After everything was burned down, we had skyscrapers, 8 stories high. We had this wonderful river that was able to stand in for the Nile, the Congo, the Amazon, everything. Jacksonville was a perfect location, and it was just a gentleman who wanted to beat another gentleman in a political race. So John Martin beat Jet Bowden, and everything fell apart. It was
they used the movie people as a scapegoat in
exactly.
a political campaign?
There were a lot more things involved, but mostly that 1916 race was about other issues. But the movie thing was a galvanizing force, you know.
Those politicians.
Oh, gosh, you know.
Well, it's too bad that they didn't stay, but the good news is that it looks as though the Norman Studios will be preserved forever. Because let's explain how the National Landmark Law works. There are about 2,900 national landmarks around the country, including, of course, some incredibly famous ones.
Right.
But if Norman Studios becomes a national landmark, that is an incredible level of protection.
Right. That's the big thing. And it's hard. But we are also hoping that we'll become part of the National park system at some point. The city, at our behest, passed a bill, and we are going, we can now turn it over to them, but they have to have enough money to do it. So all of this support, see, and the letters that I've been generating say to them, there's a lot of people, and they're from all over the country, all of our networking thing. So we're hoping that this will give the Congress the impetus to go ahead and pass a bill that takes this in. It's already done at the local level. So now all they have to do is take it in and fund it. You know?
Right. But do you still need people to write letters?
Oh, absolutely. Because all up until next April, these will be important. And I also use the letters for grant, when I'm doing a grant proposal as well. It's very helpful. So anyway, if you send a letter, you can look on our website, which is
www.normanstudios.org.
Or you can send to me, Rita Reagan, at comcast.net, and I will send you the a format for the letter and who it goes to and so forth. Or you just send me a note on email, and I'll get it to them too.
All right. But normanstudios.org, on their quest to become a national landmark, and I know you'll be successful. So kudos on this incredible journey, and thanks for sharing it with us.
Well, thank you, Melissa. We love your show, and we appreciate an opportunity to have a place to tell people about stuff.
And keep me posted.
I will.
We'll be right back. Well, it is a proven leadership program contributing to girls' academic and professional success. The Girl Scouts teach girls not only leadership, but problem-solving, team-building skills, and self-confidence. Girl Scout cookie season is about to get underway, but the program is about so much more than that. Marianne Jacobs is CEO, Girl Scouts of Gateway Council, and she joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you so much.
So good to see you. And nearly 3 in 4 girls say that because of Girl Scouts, they've become a leader in class and in the community. The data is really overwhelming when it comes to the track record of the Girl Scouts.
It truly is. Most individuals probably don't realize that we have a national organization that actually conducts research on girls and also measures the outcomes of the Girl Scout leadership experience. And what's really frightening for me is that only 1 in 5 girls actually believe she can be a leader. And so as we work and progress the girls through the Girl Scout leadership experience, then those young ladies become women such as yourself or mine and the guests that you've had prior to me, and they are active civically, they're leaders in the community, they also own small businesses, and they run for political office.
Isn't that incredible? So many CEOs and women in high office today report that they started out as children in the Girl Scouts.
In the Girl Scouts. There are 8.3 million small businesses owned by women, and 80% of those small businesses, those women were Girl Scouts.
And you even cite a youth poll, the Girl Scouts Ban Bossy Youth Poll, for some of this data. That's the national campaign asking that the term bossy be banned when it comes to girls, because so often we find that boys aren't ever called bossy in school. But when a girl is outspoken and tries to lead, she's often called bossy by her friends and even by the teacher.
Yes.
And which is so devastating.
It is devastating, and it immediately places a girl at a lower level. So, and we can all relate to that. I'm a little older than you are, but playing in the sandbox.
I don't think you are.
Playing in the sandbox, you know, or playing tag on the school playground and really stepping up to take a leadership role and then having your friends, female friends, friends even say, Marianne, you're being bossy. So we are trying to heighten the awareness of the term so that girls feel more confident and they're more willing to step out. There's also some other research that indicates that teachers, and I was a teacher, so I know this is a little sensitive, but that teachers actually give more positive recognition and call on boys to answer questions more in the classroom. And so when a boy raises their hand, a young boy raises his hand, he attracts more of the attention of the teacher than the girl. So we're actually teaching girls now, raise your hand and lead the experiment in school. Keep your hand up and be recognized, because girl behavior plays a part in this as well.
And this this type of gender bias is so subtle and implicit that teachers don't even realize, most people don't even realize how internalized it is.
It is. And it's not intentional. It's not intentional on any teacher's behalf. It's just the way that I believe we're wired. What's really interesting about the Girl Scout leadership experience is that as we teach girls to raise their hand and put their name in the hat or lead an experiment, they become more confident. And again, then the outcome is a strong leader in the community or an elected official or a woman who actually is contributing through her small business to the economic development of a community.
Absolutely. Speaking of economic development, I sold Girl Scout cookies. My mom was the troop leader. Now, when I did it, we didn't do it the way they do it today. In those days, they just said, get out and sell the cookies.
Right.
and I just walked door to door by myself, most of the time, or with another girl. And I had to go out and sell the cookies by myself in my neighborhood. And I had to fill the sheet. I couldn't come back until I filled that sheet.
Right, right.
And the bar was pretty darn high. but I did it. I sold those cookies and I got those patches on my vest. In fact, I still have the vest today and I saved it to show my daughters.
Right.
And because they've gone through Girl Scouts. So when it comes to learning about handling money, setting goals, the Girl Scout cookie program just can't be beat. And that is kicking off, in a couple months?
Yes, just very shortly.
And to this day, people here at the station ask me, are your daughters selling Girl Scout cookies at this time? Because they really want the cookies.
Well, we can make that happen. The Girl Scout cookie program is the world's largest run girl business. So we are teaching some of the skills that you mentioned, decision-making, goal-setting, money management, people skills. And one of the really great things about the Girl Scout cookie program is that the money stays local and benefits our community in a number of ways. A Girl Scout troop with their proceeds from the last cookie season, built a buddy bench at one of the monastery schools here so that when a girl or a boy doesn't have any playmates and they're concerned about being on the playground by themselves, they sit on the buddy bench and then students come and help and be their buddy, particularly Girl Scouts. But there are all sorts of opportunities for girls to use their proceeds, not only to benefit the troop, because sometimes the troop takes a trip to a historic marker or to a historic place, but oftentimes they build dog houses for Habitat, or not Habitat for Humanity. They would build homes for Habitat for Humanity, or build dog houses or different opportunities for the pets and things like that. So
yeah,
in the community.
So many opportunities. And if your daughter isn't involved, get them involved. Just contact Girl Scouts of Gateway Council. She's CEO Marianne Jacobs.
Melissa, thank you so much. We appreciate your support.
Thank you. And in a moment, weekend events with The Spectator, including a look at Jax by Jax, celebrating this area's literary voice.
Digging for buried treasure from 25 miles in the sky.
It's one thing to hear rumors or eyewitness reports. It's another thing to be able to capture that data from space.
An archaeologist uses big pictures to uncover bigger crimes, catching looters with satellites. Next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sweeping changes could be in store for Duval Public Schools, including school zone boundary shifts, school uniforms, and underperforming schools being converted into special academies. WJCT's Community Thread invites you to tune in for a conversation hosted by Melissa Ross with Duval County Superintendent Nikolai Vitti and community stakeholders about the direction of our schools. Community Thread, coming November 19th at 8 p.m. on WJCT Public Television.
Relax Radio WJCT 89.9 HD3 is your music station, playing the songs you remember best from the Beatles, Elvis, Frank Sinatra, Barbra Streisand, and Motown, 24 hours a day, only on WJCT 89.9 HD3. Learn more at wjct.org/relax.
Here you go. Welcome back. Well, this Saturday, a unique event in Riverside will showcase this city's literary talent. Jacks by Jacks features 24 local writers in the heart of the city. It's a way to find out more about this area's unique literary voice and check out some interesting local haunts all at the same time. Now, Jacks by Jacks is the brainchild of local author and FSCJ professor Dr. Tim Gilmore, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
So, Saturday, people will wander around the area around Park and King Streets in Riverside, meet some writers, have some great food, have a drink. It sounds like a great time.
I dare anybody to, try and have a bad time. It's going to be a lot of fun.
How did this all come up? How did you get this idea?
This is the second one. We did one last year. And to begin with, I wanted to do something to kind of thank the people who had been so gracious to me. You know, people like Mark Ari, who would set up readings, for me at UNF. And a lot of people were also thinking how much was going on with the literary scene in the city. And there's Bridge 8 magazine and Perversion magazine. We're starting around the same time. And I really wanted to have something that would say, hey, Jacksonville, this is your literary voice.
And these are local writers. Mm-hmm. People will have the chance to hear them, do readings, talk to them, meet them in person, and get a feel for their work.
Right. So the way it works is two writers share a venue. There are 12 venues, and they are, all small businesses around Park and King Street, places like, Riverside Liquors or Silver Cow or Cool Moose or Jacksonville Magazine offices. And two writers share a venue, and they go back and forth. So they will read or perform for about 15 or 20 minutes. So you might, for example, you might catch Fred Dale at 3 o'clock at Paperwhite Salon, or Jeff Whipple at Riverside Liquors, or Tangela Floyd at Superhero Hive Comic Book Store. And whoever you missed, you have other chances to hear at 4 or at 5 or at 6. So you can kind of, wander around, choose your own adventure, if you remember that children's book series. I think of it that way. And then there's an after party at Evervest Art Studio. That goes from 7:30 to 9:30. The event is free, but the after party is $10. But that $10 gets you, for as long as it lasts, catered food from Folk Food, music from the Ouija Brothers, and this is Sarah Crooks Flair's art studio. So, I'm not sure the water spirit, one of her wonderful creations, might have some things to do. And you can buy books there and meet a lot of people.
And meet you. You've written a lot of great books yourself.
Oh, thanks.
Let's not forget to mention that. By the way, all the food at this event, vegetarian, right? According to your news release here?
Vegetarian?
I'm just looking at your news release, Tim Gilmore.
There are options, certainly. I can't guarantee that everything will be vegetarian.
We've got options. We've got food. We've got drinks. There will be music. There will be performances. There will be Tim Gilmore. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be fun. Choose your own adventure, as Tim says, at Jacks by Jacks. Coming up Saturday, 3 to 7 p.m., 12 venues at Park and King Streets, with the after party and book signing at Evervest Art Studio. That's at Russell and King. This is a unique Jacksonville literary event, a very cool event. And thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Again, that's Saturday afternoon. And finally, this hour, lots of fun choices out there to enjoy for your very crisp fall weekend. Here she is every Thursday to take us all around town. We welcome the mistress of mayhem, the maven of mirth, the spectator.com's Carrie Speckman.
Yay!
Today. And you know,
I decided, I think, I can't remember who I was talking to. I think it was Liz Morgan, that we, that I wanted.
Well, you talked to so many people. How could you even remember?
Well, I talked to her like all the time.
Yeah, that's true.
That we wanted to work Maestro in there.
Because
we were talking about Courtney.
That reminds me of that Seinfeld episode where the guy kept demanding to be called Maestro.
Well, but I'm seeing the symphony for the first time tonight.
Oh.
And then we were talking about Courtney Lewis and do people
wouldn't
actually
it be
call
funny,
him Maestro.
Wouldn't it be funny if he started demanding to be called Maestro?
That would be awesome. I would totally call him Maestro. I'm going to call him that anyway.
So from now on, I'm going to call you the Mistress of Mayhem, the Maven of
Mirth. Or you could call me
the Maestro of...
That's your job, not mine.
Oh, geez.
Or you could just replace Maven or...
I'll figure it
out
by next
That's
Thursday.
Your job. I should hope so.
I am on the case, Spectator.
Thank you.
All right, what's happening?
Ross, tonight there is a holiday cocktail tasting at Cafe Anola.
Oh, very nice.
They're going to take some old-timey favorites like deviled eggs and shrimp cocktail, and they're going to put a new twist.
Deviled eggs have become hip again.
They're totally
My
hip.
Grandmother made those. I remember it like it was yesterday.
Let me guess. They were
with paprika on top. Yes.
They're and everywhere.
Now they make them in this newfangled kind of way.
And they have salmon and like capers and on stuff.
All right.
On
so that's tonight at Cafe Nola. Also tonight, great food at the Omni at the Signature Chef's Auction.
Yes, which is a benefit for the March of Dimes. Also, I forgot to put on here, but tonight is the Symphony in 60. They're doing a show in 60 minutes. They're going to do three of them. And you have an opportunity after the show to mix and mingle with the musicians and the maestro.
Yes, because he will very, very soon be demanding
he will not
to be
escape
called that.
My clutches.
Comedian
starts at 6.
Comedian Nick DiPaolo is in town tonight at the Comedy Club of Jacksonville. And we want to make special note of Friday's St. John's Riverkeeper Oyster Roast at the Garden Club of Jacksonville.
It is quite fancy. Have you ever been? But fancy in like a casual
way. Yeah, this is a great event and always a high point on the calendar. People
it's
love
on
this
the
thing.
River. It's really beautiful. They have tons of food and like oysters for days. Like you can't even imagine how many oysters you could possibly eat.
And this, of course, is the big fundraiser for the Riverkeeper. So get on out and enjoy that.
It's at the Garden Club. Do we say
at
that?
The Garden Club,
Fun
yes.
fact, did you know that oysters change their gender at least once during their lifetimes?
I did not know that.
These are the kind of fun facts you can learn on thespectator.com. Yeah, see, I didn't know that either.
You've just been informed in a very fascinating manner by Carrie Speckman.
What can I do?
Friday, it's Gabriel Iglesias, another
AKA
comedian.
AKA Big Fluffy.
Yeah, he's That's coming it. To the Florida Theater.
He is. People may remember, he was on last Comic Standing. He got kicked off. It was like the fourth year because he smuggled his BlackBerry on. I totally remember that. But then he was also in Magic Mike XXL or XXL. I don't really know how you...
XXL.
He was probably not a dancer, though.
Now, the fabulous Kristen Chenoweth, the Emmy and Tony Award winner... coming to town. Of course, she's known for many performances, but especially for playing Glinda in the Broadway hit Wicked. Let's listen first to the showstopper that she sings with Idina Menzel in Wicked Popular.
You're gonna be popular. I'll teach you the proper ploys when you talk to boys. Little ways to flirt and flounce. I'll show you what shoes to wear, how to fix that hair. Everything that really counts to be popular. I'll help you be popular. You'll hang with the right cohorts. You'll be good at sports. Know the slang you've got to know. So let's start, cause you've got an awfully long way to go.
That's Kristen Chenoweth on Broadway.
And you know what? She won a Tony, but it was not for her role in Wicked.
What'd she win for?
It was for, she played Sally Brown in You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown.
Oh, excellent. Well, of course, the Jacksonville Children's Chorus is bringing Kristen Chenoweth to
town. Their 20th anniversary.
Yeah, for their 20th anniversary tour. She will be performing with the children this Saturday night. Much excitement.
And I heard, I went on and read some reviews on Times Ticketmaster, which people are not kind generally on there. Mm-hmm. But like, she had 5 stars. She talks a lot in between. Apparently, she does a really good Donald Trump impression.
Oh, really?
I heard. Well, she's just...
that's funny. Well, I spoke to her about the concert. She's excited to perform on stage with the kids. Let's take a quick listen.
I have planned 2 songs with them because I have a theater in my home state of Oklahoma for kids so they can have a summer arts camp. And this is so everything I believe in. So it felt like, oh, the right thing. It's perfect that it's for them because that's who I am. And I can't wait to meet them. I'll get to meet them on the day of the show when we have sound check and rehearsal. And I'm sure it's going to be inspiring.
Kristen Chenoweth, Saturday night with the Jacksonville Children's Chorus.
A lot of people cried, I will say, in their descriptions. She brought them to tears.
That's sweet.
In a good way.
Also this weekend, it's Clifford the Big Red Dog at the Florida Theater, mm-hmm. PBS's own, Sunday.
He will be doing 2 shows at 2 and 8.
Yes, and the fair is in town again this weekend.
It's still here, and Jack's Beer Week.
Where is that happening?
Everywhere. That's okay. Why I didn't even bother to. I mean, they have like tap takeovers and brunches and hangover brunches and all kinds of stuff.
Well, enjoy it wherever you flit about. And thanks for being
flit
here.
Flit about? Oh. I don't flit about.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm a little too big to flit.
And follow Carrie on Twitter at Carrie. It's
no, at
the Spectator.
Get
Excuse
it together,
me.
Ross.
Sorry, it's one of those days.
I understand.
And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Make sure to catch our daily podcast. Subscribe to it on iTunes and Stitcher. And next on Diane Rehm, the White House asked for a Supreme Court ruling on immigration reform. What's ahead for the president's plan, prospects for reform, and what the 2016 presidential candidates say should be done. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow for our Friday Media Roundtable. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.